Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
You're listening to Cutting the Curd, hosted by Anne Saxelby. You're listening to Cutting the Curd, hosted by Anne Saxelby. You're listening to Cutting the Curd, hosted by Anne Saxelby, broadcast live to the cosmos on the Heritage Radio Network.
Good Sunday to you, and welcome to another episode of Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Anne Saxelby. Our show is being produced today by Jack Inslee and sponsored by The Barter House. The Barter House is proud to support Heritage Radio Network and its community of food lovers. The Barter House works with small family vineyards and bottlers from around the world to bring only the finest and most flavorful wines to market. Committed to sustainable agriculture and artisanal production, The Barter House offers outstanding wines at a wide range of price points to retailers, restaurateurs, and private collectors. To learn more about The Barter House, please visit them on the web at thebarterhouse.com or call 917-463-3076. So on this episode of Cutting the Curd, I am so pleased to have three really awesome, talented guests. Tia Keenan, who is a chef fromager. Tia built the cheese programs at The Modern and Casa Lula, is a culinary consultant and has a project opening in New York in 2011, which we are all eagerly anticipating. Daphne Zeppos, who is a cheese force of nature. She works with the Essex Cheese Company, which is an importer of fine European cheeses. She is an educator. She teaches at Zingerman's in their cheese program, Cheese School of San Francisco, the College of Marin, and is the co-founder of the Cheese of Choice Coalition, which we're going to talk about more later in the show. And Mateo Keeler, who is the owner of Jasper Hill Farm, founder of the Cellars at Jasper Hill Farm, a project designed to preserve Vermont's working agricultural landscape. And today we are going to be talking about raw milk cheese in the United States. So thank you guys so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having us.
It's a pleasure.
Mateo, great to be here.
Oh, you're good. The phone's working. That's always a good sign. So raw milk cheese in the United States, I mean, I think it's an amazing thing. It's a very recent development. You know, we just were doing a show about monastic cheeses. So we were talking about stuff that went back 1,500 years. Raw milk cheese in the United States has really only become a force, I would say, in the past 30 years or so. And Daphne, please correct me whenever I'm wrong, because I know I'm going to be wrong a lot. but it's a very, very important agricultural food movement that's happening in our country. And it's been recognized by a couple different bodies as something worth preserving and promoting. First by Slow Food, who founded a raw milk cheese presidium here for the United States, in a land, you know, that has kind of lost most of its culinary tradition. That was something that was singled out by Slow Food as an important thing to protect. And also by the Cheese of Choice Coalition, which Daphne is going to tell us more about. So actually, maybe that's a good way to start. Daphne, can you tell us about Cheese of Choice and how you got started with that?
Yes, absolutely. So the Cheese of Choice Coalition started, as all good things, around a table. We were actually all the way in Greece. We were on an old ways trip and it was Deborah Madison and Dan Gifford and myself talking about mold, talking about cheeses, and really being really afraid that the 60-day rule that we have today in this country, which means that all cheeses must be pasteurized if they are under 60 days. And, of course, you can sell cheeses that are raw milk if they're over 60 days. But there were sort of covert, how can we say this, a slight covert action, a slight covert tendency that that rule was going to change and that in reality we wouldn't be able to have raw milk cheeses in this country anymore.
And when was this? When was this meeting?
This was in 2000.
Okay.
Very early 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we wanted to do, and Dan Gifford, who was, you know, the president of Old Ways at the time, said, well, you know, it really is about informing the consumer. And so we put together a little movement where we involved a lot of the cheeses or cheese shops around the country, informing them and their customers about what raw versus pasteurized is, which are the raw milk cheeses in this country that are made here or that are brought over that would be in jeopardy, and what now do consumers feel about it.
Mm-hmm.
Would they like to see, for example, a country in which we can't have Parmigiano Reggiano, which is raw milk, Gruyere, French or Swiss, which is raw milk, Roquefort. And so that's what we did. We just got a hefty amount of signatures together from the consumer who said, no, you know, we really want to preserve this law. We really want to have access to those cheeses. And I just brought you three of the most strident classics here. But we're talking about a whole slew of cheeses that, you know, we wanted to make sure will exist in this country, plus the option for the American cheesemaker to be able to make raw milk cheeses if they're aged over 60 days. And so I was the co-founder in that grassroots moment when we put that together, and we brought in Kathy Donnelly from the Vermont University at the time to compile a white paper, as it's called, which means she brought in the scientific side of the argument. And as we grew a little bit bigger, then the cheese importers, I think it's of America, also suddenly got very interested. Because the enormous numbers that are brought in and the sales that are made by the likes of Gruyere and raw milk cheddar and Parmigiano Reggiano, suddenly we had some funding.
Interesting.
Yes. And so now we were able to, you know, go more mainstream with all that, you know, go mainstream, have some funding. And what we did basically is we helped solidify the 60-day rule as it stands today. Now, this is now nearly 10 years later, and we're again at this tenuous crossroads.
And can I ask, who did you present your findings to, the signatures, the scientific papers?
We went to Washington, and I'm going to have to think of the body of which of the government networks we actually approached to help solidify the status quo at the time.
Interesting. Very interesting. And so, actually, does anybody here in the room know the history of the 60-day rule?
It was something that was implemented after World War II to deal with E. coli in cheddar cheese. So it came about, with a very narrow focus. And part of the problem with the 60-day rule is that there's several families of cheeses that actually become riskier the older they get, like higher moisture, mold ripened, and washed rind cheeses, for instance, are actually safer when they're younger than when they age.
That's interesting. For some reason, I always thought it was a protectionist thing for American cheese against French cheeses like Camembert Brie. So thank you, thank you for debunking that. So, I mean, raw milk, I feel like, I don't know, I've been thinking about this a lot lately. I attended an ACS, an American Cheese Society session this past August, in which Matteo and actually Yvonne Larcher, who's a cheese consultant, made an excellent presentation about raw milk. And well, no, it was about terroir, actually. But the thing that I took away from that session was that we shouldn't, in this country, in America, I feel like we shouldn't be talking about terroir yet. Terroir is something that evolves over many centuries. Over, you know, Matteo is always fond of pointing out that terroir is not just about the taste of place, but it's also about the economy of people and animals and land that produce a product and that live off of that product. And so I feel like what we should be talking about is raw milk, because that is the most essential building block of cheese making. And that's what we really need to preserve and promote and celebrate in this country, if our cheese tradition is to continue on its upward track. What do you guys think? I don't know.
Go ahead, Tia.
Well, I mean, I wanted to start, actually, because this, the reason that I'm here today is because a couple of weeks ago, I was at Saxelby Cheesemongers and was talking to Anne. And at the time, I had been quoted in the New York Times in an article which was about FDA crackdowns on small producers and the unfortunate situation of a particular producer in Washington State. And Anne and I had, you know, lots of opinions, and we weren't on the radio, and we were talking as two people who've worked together for many years and who share a passion. And we had a lot to say, and we felt like that a lot of what we were saying was stuff that we were willing to say privately and not really willing to talk about publicly. And we also talked about, you know, what we felt about the science. And being that Anne and I, neither one of us are scientists, certainly we are reticent about talking about science, you know, publicly.
Sure.
In a detailed way.
Basically, I think a nice, clean way of saying what we believe in is we believe that most of the little critters are good.
Yeah.
But.
And so, you know, I think when we were talking about doing this show, we wanted to just sort of begin a conversation that was a little more public, because in the cheese world right now, if you get people who work in the cheese business and you get them together, what inevitably the topic of conversation is what's happening in terms of regulation in this country, where we think that's going, what's been happening with this sort of quote unquote, you know, food contamination scares, and what the effect of this was going to be on cheese making in the United States.
Right, which in the bottom of it is all of our livelihoods here on this show.
Yeah, and this was, you know, definitely something. I mean, Anne works almost exclusively with American artisan cheese. And although I've worked with cheeses from all over the world, more and more the focus of my work is American artisan cheese. And so we actually had a moment where we both said, you know, if American artisan cheese is going to sort of travel down the drain as regulation becomes more and more the focus of how and why cheese is made, what are we going to do?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, we've built our careers on teaching, talking, and feeding people American artisan cheese. And we've benefited very much from the growth of American artisan cheese culture. And so when we're thinking about raw milk, regulation of producers, what is the meaning of that to us in a very sort of broad way?
Yeah. And so, I don't know, I guess I have a question for Matteo. I mean, you make both raw milk and pasteurized cheeses. I don't know, do you see your business changing in any way as you guys have sort of taken on a sort of larger role in the American cheese movement? Will you continue your practices as they stand? Or
absolutely. I mean, you know, first of all, I think it it's important to recognize that it is possible to produce safe raw milk cheeses of all styles, and it is possible to manage risk. As a food manufacturer, you know, we take the health and well-being of our customers as one of the most important tenets of our business. And, you know, it's never been a good business plan to poison your customers. And, you know, with that in mind, you know, there are risks to eating. There have always been risks. There always will be risks. There are systems that exist to enable producers to monitor and manage those risks and to ensure that the products that are putting out the door, you know, aren't going to be a liability for themselves, for their customers, you know, retailers and wholesalers, and for consumers and the industry at large. And one of the things that I think is coming to light is that as, you know, the artisan cheese industry in the U.S. has really popped over the last few years, you know, anybody can just set up and decide to make cheese. You don't have to know anything about food safety. You don't have to know anything about sanitation. You don't have to know anything about the process by which you can mitigate, you know, risk.
Or even knowing what the potential risks are.
Right, exactly. You know, the fact is that every day we take milk that's produced in a barn where there's, you know, I'm not sure if I can say this on a manure.
You can say whatever you want on this show, can't you, Anne?
We're internet radio.
That's right. You know, there's like cow shit and you know, microbe heaven on the barn side. And we're taking, you know, this milk and turning it, fermenting it, incubating the natural flora in that milk. And if anything is out of balance, you're going to have a problem. And... you know, the thing about it is that you can't see these problems. Mm-hmm. So unless you have, you know, testing protocols in place, unless you're monitoring your environment, unless you're, you know, really taking the steps to, like, develop baselines for, you know, milk quality and, you know, standard plate counts, like total bacteria counts in your milk, and you know what's living in your drains, and you're keeping your finger on the pulse of the environment in which you're producing these fermented foods, then you're flying blind. And my sense is that a lot of small-scale artisan cheesemakers haven't gotten there yet, and that's a big problem. I think probably the scariest thing about this FDA push over the past year is that the resources to really educate and elevate the technical capacity of producers isn't there. And so until we have, you know, technical people on the ground that are going to be able to help small cheese makers across the country set up, like, risk management programs and really, you know, educate them as to what those risks are and how to control them. And then, you know, there's just the hammer, and the big hammer of government. And that's, you know, that's really problematic for a lot of different reasons, primarily because it seems like there's some kind of political agenda at hand. So
Well, this would be a good time to talk maybe about, you know, when we were talking about getting this show together, I also, Tia and I thought it would be a great idea to have someone with a European perspective, you know, someone who works for a European cheese consortium, to talk about the different protocols and standards that exist there. I feel like, I don't know, Daphne, you certainly have seen mm-hmm. more of this than anybody else, and I feel like The education part mm-hmm. and the standards and the resources for developing, you know, cheese making businesses in Europe is quite different than here. Can you do a comparison of what kind of standards are required or encouraged?
Well, let me start. I want to pick up where Matteo left off because I think it's an incredibly key issue. When we first got together put together what you just talked about in the very beginning, the first raw milk cheese consortium, American raw milk cheese consortium for slow food, we got together. Actually, it was here in New York at the French Culinary Institute. There was a whole group of us cheesemongers. Piero Sardo had come over, and we were trying all the raw milk cheeses. Now, I think this was in 2002. That we did that, late 2002. And the variety of raw milk cheeses that were produced in an artisanal and farmstead volume, if you want, at the time, was minute. I think we had, I want to say we didn't have more than 25 cheeses, maybe 30 cheeses in total. And we wanted to find, you know, the three or four of those cheeses that were really fantastic, that would be the ambassadors of this consortium. Now, the amount of incredibly delicious raw milk cheeses that are made on that small scale in the United States has, I don't know how many times over, has it doubled.
Mm-hmm.
We have such an incredible array, and sometimes I look and I giggle just thinking at how, you know, we couldn't find a variety large enough to represent this consortium at the time, and now we would be spoiled to find these ambassadors. We would have such an incredible choice. Well, with that comes the education. And so now we have the Vermont Institute of Artisan Cheese that is providing those type of classes for small cheesemakers. The same thing is happening at the College of Marin, that's putting a cheese making certification program together. And while I don't deal with the cheese making part, I'm the one that sort of broadens the horizons, does taste education and history of cheese and so forth. But these are the institutions that are going to come in here and really protect that small cheesemaker. What I wanted to say about the College of Marin is at least two-thirds of it has to do with sanitation practices, health practices, protocols. That is really what we're hammering in to this startup cheesemaker. And the whole of Marin and Sonoma is rife with little cheesemaking operations that are starting. And they all start on the back of their stove and then move into the shack outside and then become slightly bigger. And so that the sanitation practices and all of that is going to protect these new upcoming small cheesemakers. And VIAC, of course, case in point, you know, is that's what the courses they provide are invaluable for us to move further.
Yeah, and Wisconsin as well,
absolutely.
I think, are very good at the dairy science,
yes,
end of things.
Absolutely.
And actually, there was just, I think, close to $1 million dollars left in Oregon by the University of Oregon was given, I think, close to $1 million for an endowment to create a cheese-making college, basically.
Wow.
So, you know, I totally agree. You know, we're building the infrastructure to be able to supply those services at this point. We're just behind. And in the meantime, you know, there are some real problems out there. When you know, I think the FDA, I think they called it a study. They visited 120 some cheesemakers, and 25% of them, you know, came back positive for Listeria contamination in their plant. No, there aren't any sicknesses associated with any of the cheesemakers or the cheeses that are out there from these producers, but that's very worrying.
Let's talk a little bit about, I mean, Daphne, if you mm-hmm. feel comfortable, we were talking about it before the show just a little bit, and we were talking about, you know, again, the European standard of things and the way that things are measured. And in the U.S., we kind of go for
zero tolerance,
ultimate sterilization mm-hmm. versus...
Not just in the product, but also on facility.
Right. And so do you feel comfortable commenting on...
Sure, I'll comment a little bit. I am absolutely and by no means an expert in this. But if you look at the training processes that young cheesemakers go through in France, it's a very standard training. It's not as a master's degree. It is definitely the apprenticeship of a craft. So there's all these schools that give that foundation to a craft, to the young apprentice cheesemakers of the future, and then the cheesemakers. And now the health department there, and so now the government body that regulates the sanitation issues on the farm and in the dairy are the same. And they are practiced, they're called the veterinarian services in France. It's service vétérinaire, but it's so much bigger than that. But what I like about it, and I know so little, and I wish I had a better capacity to explain it to you, but I don't have the information here. For which I can, you know, I can talk with, with knowing exactly what I'm talking about. All I know is that they come into the dairy after they have inspected the farm, the water, and so through the animals and the milk, do they come in and inspect the dairy and cheesemaking facility, which is a completely different way than we do it. For us, it's two entirely different bodies of sanitation.
Yeah, Matteo, what are your comments on that?
I'd say that like the FDA inspectors that we see through our facility don't know anything about cheese, and so that's a big problem. Because you can't be well regulated by a regulator that doesn't understand what you're doing.
Actually, to tell you a quick little funny story. I mean, so this Ari Weisenzweig, who Daphne works with, I thought that was one of the funniest things ever when he described people running a business and not really knowing what they're doing. It's like it's people being out on a football field, but nobody knows which way you're supposed to be running or who else is on your team or, you know, what the rules of the game are. It is, if the inspectors don't know about cheese, yeah, then it's just like the system is broken from the very most bottom level.
Well, I think also, you know, in this country, not just in food, but in a lot of areas, we don't really look at process. We are end result. We make judgments based on end results, not on process. And so you have, for instance, in large industrial food facilities, for instance, where they process beef. You have, beef being dipped in ammonia because the end result is that the beef is, quote unquote, not contaminated. So we're looking really at ignoring process and going for, the sort of very baseline supposedly scientific end result.
So which is what Matteo was talking about. When the inspectors come in, I'm sure they test... they test your cheese, right? And they test your milk. Can you tell us a little bit about the testing that the inspectors perform?
We're regulated by the state of Vermont, and the Agency of Agriculture is, comes once a quarter to inspect our plant, and once a month they pull a milk sample. The FDA has been here twice since we've been in business. We saw them the second year we were making cheese here, and then we didn't see them again for 5 years. And getting back to that, I think the Bush administration gutted the regulatory infrastructure for across the board. If you look at like the regulation of the oil industry, the regulation of the food industry, the regulation of the banking industry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the FDA's budget was cut by $140 million, and the FDA office in Vermont was actually closed. So there's one FDA agent for all of northern Maine, northern New Hampshire, northern Vermont, and upstate New York. One, okay? That's a big problem. We need robust regulation in order to, you know, look what happens to the banking industry without regulation. Look what, you know, look what happens to any industry if you don't have good regulation. Regulation is not necessarily a problem. The problem is the approach, right? So
the process.
You know, the Obama administration has come in and started funding the FDA, there's a political mandate to show that there's action being taken to, like, secure the safety of the food supply.
Mm-hmm.
And as a consequence, the FDA has set targets for criminal prosecutions as a measure of their success, right? And they're not hiring microbiologists and food scientists, they're hiring criminal investigators out of the FBI and law enforcement, people that don't know anything about food but know how to put together a case, right? So, I mean, the whole paradigm needs to shift towards, you know, a regulator that's capable of helping businesses, large and small, produce safe food.
Absolutely. And establishing protocols that work for producers of all sizes.
You know, I just want to really reiterate that we are not against regulation. We're a small business. When the FDA comes, it's a disruption. You know, it's hard on our business. It's stressful. But if in the void and the chaos of you know, the food industry out there, we need some standards. And personally, I believe that the cheese industry should self-regulate, should develop standards. There should be you know, standards. The Vermont Cheese Council is going to be developing food safety standards for Vermont cheesemakers. If you want to be a member of the Vermont Cheese Council, it's likely someday that you're going to have to, you know, have a risk management plan, and you're going to have a testing program, and you're going to have the pieces in place that are going to ensure that as a Vermont cheesemaker, you're doing the right things to protect the industry in Vermont.
Mark, I was talking a little bit with Mark Fisher about that. He's a cheesemaker at Woodcock Farm, and he told me that the Vermont Cheese Council actually sponsored a workshop last year to become HACCP certified in Vermont, which is great, because, you know, then that's the kind of thing that could potentially, you know, give small producers access to the certification, or at least give them an intro to this kind of certification, which can be pretty costly and difficult to navigate if you don't have a body helping you with that. So I think that's a very interesting point, self-regulation. And actually, I remember, you know, that comes back to a meeting of the Raw Milk Cheese Consortium that I was able to attend back in 2003. I mean, I think you guys, we were talking about developing standards for raw milk cheeses to, you know, ensure that they were protected. I don't know if this is the proper time to segue, but that story in the New York Times came out right about the same time as Congress was passing the Food Safety Modernization Act, which is basically a bill that was talking about regulations of just this you know, just this kind of thing, and providing different standards and different exemptions for small producers, to ensure that, you know, it is fair, and that somebody who is Kraft Foods is, you know, abiding by different standards than a small farm like Jasper Hill Farm. So I think It's a very interesting time, and I feel like, you know, you're talking about that kind of criminalization of production that I think, you know, that this act was really commenting on. I think it did end up passing with the provision for small producers, but it's a very kind of, I don't know, it's a hostile time, it seems, for the small producer.
It's a hard time, but I think it's only a hard time because as an industry, we haven't done the work that we need to do in order to position ourselves as competent, educated, and responsible manufacturers. I'm getting back to the food safety bill. I think there's a different level of regulation for farms that are have less than $500,000 in gross sales.
Correct. Yeah.
And who distribute their product within 275 miles of the farm, and that's not Jasper Hill Farm. Which is fine. I just wanted to like put that out there. Is that Jasper Hill Farm actually falls outside of those exemptions, and we milk 40 cows. We're not a big farm, but we're big enough not to meet that limit. And honestly, that's fine. I think that we need to. Be capable of producing food that's as safe or safer than Kraft food. And statistically, we don't pose the kind of risk that, a big industrial producer will. And I think that should be taken into account when by regulators. What we're seeing and what exists in Europe is a risk-based, approach to regulation. And if you're making high-risk products, if you've got a lot of employees, if you've got, a situation where, you don't control your milk supply, if you've got, there's all kinds of different factors that, can play into the risk associated with a cheese. And instead of, like, a blanket regulation like the 60-day rule, which, we make raw milk 60-day cheeses that, we cut our teeth on and kind of established our reputation making Constant Bliss, which was the only raw milk mold-ripened cheese in the U.S. You can do it, and you can make those cheeses safely. But the truth is that those cheeses are actually probably safer when they're 30 days. Mm-hmm. Constant Bliss would be a safer cheese when it was 30 days. And the science should take that into account. I think that, in Europe, the way that regulation works is you can pretty much do anything you want as long as your finished product meets, standards, microbiological standards, right? So there's a tolerance for Listeria. I think it's 10 colony-forming units per gram. So it's not a zero tolerance. You can have low levels of Listeria. Listeria doesn't become pathogenic until it reaches levels of over 100. And, the big issue is that in Europe, the infrastructure, the testing services, all that infrastructure exists to support producers, and the regulatory system also exists to support producers, not punish them. And I think it's going to be a long time before that kind of culture can change at the federal level. But as cheesemakers, I think, and as retailers, we have the opportunity to work with our state regulators who know us and who live in our communities to educate them. And the Vermont Institute for Artisan Cheese is going to be putting together a program for regulators, which I think is brilliant.
That's great.
Now, Neil's Yard Dairy did this in England, and you know, it makes a huge difference for cheesemakers to have an inspector walk through the door that understands both what they're up against on the day-to-day and also where the real risks are, not, you know...
And helping people develop and manage their facilities and their cheesemaking practices accordingly.
It's a system that's created to have production of food that's safe, but also that values the culture from which that food is coming from. And I think that, you know, I agree with Matteo that on a federal level, it's a long, hard road. But I think it's much easier for people to, on a more local level, on a state level, for instance, to understand the value of the culture of artisan food production. And that we're not just talking about one cheesemaker, you're talking about the community that the cheesemaker is working in. You're talking about the culture of animal husbandry. You're talking about the embracing of tradition, the growing of sort of old human traditions that have now have value in this relatively young culture, which is, you know, American culture. Matteo, I think that you were in this article. There's a great article that was in put in the Harvard Journal on the called The Ecology of Value. Were you in that? Which I think for anyone who's interested in this issue, to look at to take the cultural perspective is a really, really important article to read. And it talks in this article about why we support artisan cheesemaking. And there's several perspectives to take. There's the perspective that we like artisan cheese. It tastes good. It's something that we enjoy eating. It's another position is that we support artisan cheese because we support local communities. Mm-hmm. And we support production of food on a small level, made by hand, by people in our communities. And also, you know, that we support on a sort of very fundamental, almost sort of philosophical level, the tradition of cheesemaking, which is many, many thousands of years old and part of... part of the human experience, actually, on a very basic level. And so when I, you know, people ask me about food safety and cheese recalls and all of these things all the time, and I feel as someone who has worked to feed people cheese and teach people about cheese over this amazing decade of growth in American artisan cheese, that I almost have, not only am I not necessarily qualified to talk from a scientific perspective, but I have this sort of cultural obligation to get people to think about a sort of big picture on artisan food and specifically cheese. And that, you know, I'm not here to tell you that Listeria is okay, but I am here to make you question giving things up that are so ancient so quickly. And we don't know what we've lost until it's gone. And I would love for as someone who helps create culture, that we start to ask those questions of the people we make culture with in our culture before it's gone, and that we think about cultural importance. And this is also ties into Europe, because basically in Europe, everyone agrees that cheese making is vital to not just the economy, but also to the culture. And I think that that's something that we haven't really been able to talk about a lot in this whole food safety debate because everyone is so scared of Salmonella, E. coli, Listeria that we're ready to throw like the baby out with the bathwater because the whole thing is just too frightening.
Right. Right. When the reality is, you know, obviously.
Well, the reality is that Listeria, I was last night in prepping for the show, was looking at a study, the most recent study on foodborne illnesses by the CDC. And you're looking at about, you know, a little over 2,000 cases of Listeria on their last, annually on their last study. And when you're looking at Listeria, you're comparing that to, you know, 2,000 cases of Listeria to 2 million cases of Salmonella.
And the source of that Listeria is often not cheese. It's often other products.
Yeah, and cool. It's also, you know, the fatality is 0.2% of 2,000 people on the last study annually. And Mateo brought this up. You know, there's this idea of risk. We have this very false notion in this country that there's such a thing as no risk. And there is such a thing as no risk. It's called being dead. you know, that's the only to live is to
or boy in the bubble.
Yeah, to encounter risk at every moment. Being a human being is a very risky proposition.
Well, so to bring it back to the Cheese of Choice Coalition for a second. So I feel like, you know, you started this 10 years ago, but it's probably more important right now than ever before. How can people get involved with it? Are there, is that group, taking any action, right now, or are there plans? Because, you know, as we were saying, you know, there is such an amazing, groundswell of support for these products from, consumers. And, you know, I feel like they need to grow together. Like Mateo was saying, the infrastructure of the industry needs to grow and improve. But with more talking from the consumer perspective, from the retailer perspective, that can only strengthen the argument. So is there anything at work?
Well, part of the Cheese of Choice Coalition's work, I think, was to stave off that particular tendency at that moment in time. What I like, and so I think that in order to get more involved, one should go to the American Cheese Society and talk to those committees. There's a raw milk cheese committee there. There's all that history. The American Cheese Society also was part of the Cheese of Choice Coalition very, very early on. So I think it should be through the ACS that people should come in and become active. What I like about our industry is that it's still very small and very nimble. And this is the moment, it's a take action moment for us. I think Tia is very right, that we can influence the way regulations are going to be set precisely because we are educating the regulators. We talked about Neal's Yard Dairy, the Vermont, the VIAC, but also in California, Cowgirl Creamery is doing exactly the same thing, meeting up with government to try and put down regulations for cheese making, for cheese mongering, for their counters and so forth. So this is a propitious moment. And, you know, we're small, nimble. All we need is a little bit more funds.
Yeah. Classic.
Classic.
Well, I never, yeah, it's funny. Being in New York City and being a business in New York City, you know, that's subject to, you know, many inspections as well. I never thought I would say that I wanted more regulators, but I think you're exactly right. I think that there's a certain kind of symbiotic relationship that can be developed and should be developed. And it's all of our responsibility in the end to make sure that that information about raw milk cheese making is being shared and that people can forward the craft. We're almost out of time. Does anybody have any sort of final comments that they want to make sure get out there before we wrap up?
I have an interesting idea. I think that that more and more we're actually going to end up being regulated by insurance companies, and that may be some great opportunities there. Ultimately, you know, government is not that good at a lot of things, but private industry is more nimble, and I see kind of the American regulatory system moving more towards a system of third-party audits and certifications. The FDA has already said that any cheesemaker that adopts a particular third-party audit system will only be visited by the FDA every 5 years. Okay? So you're talking about developing food products under the auspices of a third-party audit system, which our customers are starting to require of us. More and more, I believe that insurance industries, I would venture to say that in 10 years, you may be able to make almost anything you want if you can buy insurance, which is kind of a crazy idea, but I have a feeling that we will end up there one day.
That is very interesting. I hadn't thought about that.
Privatization of risk.
A new approach.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to thank everybody for being on the show today. It's been a really, interesting conversation. I definitely have learned a lot. It's always humbling because there's so much.
I felt like this conversation
work to be done
could have gone on for 6 hours. And
I think we should definitely do a follow up.
It's
possible,
to be continued conversation. There's no question about that.
Yeah, if possible, get somebody get somebody from the European perspective too to talk a little bit about how things are done over there and what we can learn. Amazing thanks to all of you guys for being to talk about this. And we'll see you next week on Cutting the Curd.
Thanks, Mateo.
Thanks, Mateo.
Thanks, Daphne.
Thanks, Anne.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.